Welcome to Accounting High.
Previously on Accounting High.
The purpose of VeriSage was the only place time spent should matter is in prison. Mm-hmm. Now, that's debatable, right? We can have a fight about that. We can have an argument about that.
Yeah.
I know you keep time records, but you don't do billing, which is fine. What do you do with the time records that you keep?
I think we're capacity planning with it. I know my principal at Accounting High would not be too pleased to hear this. That's Ron Baker. Eventually, I'm going to have you guys both on at the same time, and we'll get to Baker, talking about this.
He's living in a time warp of because he's still talking about timesheets, which nobody's doing.
No other business uses timesheets.
My nutrition uses a timesheet.
Who does?
My nutrition uses a timesheet. You can't run a program. You can't supervise 1,000 people without a timesheet.
You say it's a management tool. To manage what? Do you really manage CPAs? I don't believe you manage knowledge workers.
Check me out right here, yo.
Yeah, right. This March Madness game is so tight. Start with the 64 team bracket. We did it right. Journey ends with two now. It's Stats and Uncat. Uncat came too far to bow down to Stats. Jason may think he can plow through Uncat, but when he making up facts, they raking up Stats.
Tune in for the ABC tournament update. What's up, homie?
Not much, man. Nominations rolling in. Students signing up for sophomore year.
This is gonna be a good year. Accountant Bracket Challenge. It's the Accountant Bracket Challenge, the ABC tournament. Go in today. abc.accountinghigh.com.
There have been so many nominations, it's blowing my mind how many accounting things are out there making people's lives better. It's wild.
Yep. There is some cream rising to the top. We got a lot of new contestants, a lot of new love for some new apps, new people. It's going to be a joy. The tournament will be starting March 19th. Tune in live, our YouTube live shows. It's going to be amazing. Let's talk about one of our sponsors, Byron.
Yeah. Stanford Tax, which I will admit, I only learned about them from them becoming a sponsor of the tournament, and I'm impressed. It's pretty rad.
Ooh, I feel a lot of that. I've heard a lot of people say, what is Stanford Tax? How does it work? What do they do? And we're here to tell you today. You go in, you connect your tax software. If you're a tax preparer and you're working with Access, Pro Systems, UltraTax, Lacerte, Pro Series, Drake, any of them, you connect your tax software. It generates your personalized organizer questions for you. Byron, it's slick, isn't it? Have you seen it?
I've seen the videos on their site. So damn easy, so smooth. I'm shocked this didn't already exist, to be honest.
Easy as 1, 2, 3. Connect your tax software, generate the personalized questions, receive your PDFs. Stanford Tax, check them out. They're a proud sponsor of the ABC tournament. abc.accountinghigh.com.
See you there.
Thanks for playing. Peace out, homies.
Our class, it's the guide. Please take a seat. Step into this unique guidance session. Navigate with me. It's the capital S. Oh yes, I'm fresh. C-O-O-T-Y'OKR'. See, the show is intended to guide you with advice. Vision goes on mission. It's time Accounting High. Yeah, this profession. I think they're in the mood for some fun and inspiration.
Hell yeah.
Okay. What up, Scott? Gotta lead with ambition.
What's that, greed?
Gotta grab your attention.
Intention?
And it's gotta be abundant.
Public accountant.
And I'ma continue to put the rap down with impact now. And if you're active listening, mind the imagination gap now. Yeah, Janitor Scott, coming to you live from the closet with a bucket and a mop. So find a cozy spot. We all want financial freedom. A-C-C-O-U-N-T-I-N-G-H-I-G-H. Preach. Putting this course together. Sit back, relax, open your mind. Class is in session.
Guidance class at Accounting High. It's guidance class at Accounting High, and it's guidance.
Introducing the star of our show,
Scotty, Ed Mandlowitz, and Ron Baker.
We're gonna have a problem here.
Students, class is in session. We have very special episode for you today. We got two of the most prolific people in the accounting profession, in my eyes, coming at you from two different sides of the ring. I'm the moderator. We're going to talk about something real. Why don't you guys say hello to our students?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Mendelowitz, and looking forward to talking with Ron. I just want to tell you that I saw Ron speak in person at the AICBA conferences. I never met him, but I have the highest regard for him. I also want to tell you, I read every one of his books. You got to be looking to learn from people. You got to look to find out where you agree or don't agree and find out where to come from. And you have to look to continuously learn.
Ron Baker from Verisage. Ron, can you introduce yourself and maybe give a few opening remarks?
Well, Scotty, I think I'm the principal of this place. I'm not sure.
You
he must have fired me. But,
you are the principal of Accounting High.
Look, I'm looking forward to this. I've never met Ed, and we've corresponded over the years and emailed and never met in real life. And I've read many of his writings, and I'm looking forward to the discussion. I agree with him. I learn from people I disagree with. I don't learn from people I agree with. So I look forward. I rather have questions I can't answer rather than answers I can't question.
All right.
Looking forward to it.
So we're going to have a nice clean match here. So I run a practice, as you both know, as the students may know as well. And I've been heavily, heavily influenced by Ron over the years. He has taught me how to run and how to price at my practice. We never, ever tracked time or even thought about pricing on time. We always had fixed fees. I started value pricing through your scripture, Ron. You taught me how to build my practice and value pricing, and it was the Wild West, and it was fun, and we would just throw numbers. I would throw numbers sometimes on there, and people would pay it, and it was great, and we were making a ton of money. But as I exited the different roles that I was playing and the pricing and the sales in particular, I have come to realize I think my team is pricing on time. And this was not until I had a recent conversation with Ed that I was struck with this news. So Ed asked me, so I know that you track time. What are you using it for? I said, capacity planning, because that's what I thought we were using it for. And that's what I've been defending us on our use of time for tracking it. Well, as I'm listening to my team and during a meeting, they were looking back at some of the hours spent, and they used that to price based on the time that we spent. So they're looking at it to plan capacities or plan capacity for new clients, and now they're using it to price. So I'm stuck.
Well, I'm in favor of keeping timesheets. I am not in favor of billing based on time, except in certain circumstances. I'm also in favor of a subscription model where you charge a client a fixed fee for the entire year, which covers everything with certain exceptions. And then you do a change order the way Ron recommends it. When something is being done by a practice that shouldn't be done, it's the fault of management. One of the points I get from Ron's books is that you shouldn't keep timesheets because then the tendency is you're going to bill on time and you're going to base things on time. So you just proved the point that Ron's making. However, you're defeating the point that I make that you should keep track of time for other reasons.
So I thought that's why we were keeping it. My other co-host, Ackerman, who you both know, you've both been on episodes with Ackerman, he warned me this would happen. He's a strict follower of you, Ron, and he warned me that if we started tracking the time, we would start pricing on it. And the reason we were tracking it was when I stepped away and we went full hybrid and we were fully remote at our firm, I had no way to know what was going on. If people just said they were too busy, and I just needed that data to be able to say, yeah, we don't need to hire anybody. We're fine on capacity. So at first, that's why I needed it. And that's why we got it at first. And it wasn't until I was further and further away from the firm that they started using that data in other ways. So, Ron, the floor is open.
You get what you measure, period. And you'll get it good and hard, even if it ruins your firm. This is why KPIs and what we measure and what we pay attention to is so important. And it doesn't surprise me that your team is using time to price because they're filling out a timesheet in 6-minute increments. They think their inventory is time. And it's not. That's, in fact, this is how the timesheet came about in 1919 in law firms. It was a tool to check the price. It's cost plus pricing on steroids. And of course, it's inextricably linked between filling out a timesheet and pricing and valuing our work based on time. That's why this link needs to be broke. There are thousands of firms today that don't have timesheets, that still price, that still do capacity planning, that still do proper project management, that can tell you who their A players are and their F players without looking at timesheets. Timesheets aren't predictive of a successful CPA. They are enormously costly to keep in place. We have to track time. People have to lie on timesheets, fudge on timesheets. Ed, I know, and I've heard you say many times, if you lie on your timesheet, you shouldn't be a CPA. Well, it's hard to be a good citizen in a bad society. Guess what? People lie on their timesheets. We may not like it. We may not think it's ethical, but it happens. It's ubiquitous. My colleague Ed Kless has done surveys around the world on this very issue. How many people lie, fudge, borrow, steal, swap time on their timesheet? It's well over 75%. And those are the ones that admit it. And I think the other 25% are lying. This is a superfluous data point if you use the other processes that go along with value pricing. What you're seeing here, Scott, is a system. You can't just take one part of a system, keep it in place, and think you're going to change the entire system. Systems don't work that way. Systems, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that's why when I started getting into pricing, I realized very, very quickly that the real cancer in this profession is not the billable hour. That's the symptom. That's the fever. The real cancer is the timesheet, because it keeps us mired in the very mentality that your team is starting to materialize, which is our value resides in the time that we spend. It's the labor theory of value. It goes all the way back to Marxism and all the way back to Socrates and Aristotle, if you want to trace it that far. And it's a flawed theory. It's been absolutely refuted, and there's better ways to go. And so I don't think you need timesheets, and I think you should get rid of them, because they measure the wrong things.
Ed?
Well, I don't agree with him. I don't agree with some of the points he said. I also think that when you have timesheets, though, to take an argument from him, it changes the mindset of management and the people working there. So to that extent, he's right. But I think you need timesheets to manage. Now, I got to tell you that there are a lot of people working in firms. I've tried doing it with timesheets, without timesheets. The billing, when I started my practice with Peter Weinstein in 1988, I took clients from my former practice that were all on a time basis, and we decided to put everybody on a fixed fee. Now, of course, special projects, we would do extra, we'd bill differently, an extra. So we put all our clients on a fixed fee and the subscription model at that point. By the way, it speeded up my cash flow, because when I put people on a subscription model, on January 1st, they got a bill. When they were on a time basis, they got the bill for January's work in February. So I speeded up my cash flow by over a month just by switching. But I cut out all the arguments and everything. But the pricing on time is a thing of the past as far as I'm concerned for most firms. All the large firms are doing fixed fees. But they keep track of the time for other reasons. And it's the other reasons. I buy into that it changes the mindset, but it's the fault of management, the way the firm is run and the way the staff are made to use the timesheets, or the way the timesheets are being used. I asked you when we had the interview if you did timesheets. It was actually a throwaway question at the end of our interview. We had a very good conversation. I said, gee, let me just ask him. And you said you use it, but you don't use it for billing. But something happened from the time you started the firm to the time you left the firm to the time you stuck your nose into it that got away from your concept or the way you wanted it done. And so I blame you.
Oh, I'm 100% at fault here. I'm at fault for us starting to track it in the first place, because I got resistance at first. I kept trying to defend it, and this is how it creeps in, and this is the mindset, and it creates an artificial ceiling. That's what I have done, and that's what my team is doing and using it for. They're saying, well, if it took us about this much last year to do, then we'll create the price based on that. Ed, when you keep saying this is a management tool, I'm realizing in real life that it is really hard to create a system around value. That's why we went to time. I needed something that I could step away from that could keep running without me, and it created a system, but I've just created a system that has a cap on it, basically.
Well, I was just going to say, like Ed, when I joined this profession in 1984, I worked at Pete Mark Mitchell. We gave fixed prices all the time in our department, but those prices were built on hourly budgets. It was still cost plus pricing. There is no correlation between labor and costs and desired profit and value to the customer. None. Zero. I can spend 1,000 years writing a book that I think is wonderful and the market completely rejects. I can't run around and wave my, you know, sign and say, hey, the world owes me a living. Buy my book. Look how much time I spent. It's the wrong system. And yet, look what we're measuring. And you say it's a management tool. To manage what? Do you really manage CPAs? I don't believe you manage knowledge workers. We should manage the work, not the workers. And that requires project management and capacity planning. And that means we project capacity going forward, not looking backwards with the rearview mirror. To run a firm based on timesheets is the equivalent of timing your cookies with your smoke alarm. Not only is it a lagging indicator, it's a ridiculous indicator, because it's not predictive of any CPA success. None. Somebody can look great on a timesheet and be a complete hack. And I won't get the granular information off the timesheet to know they're a complete hack. The only way I can judge the competence of another CPA is to use judgment, not ridiculous measurements like input measurements of how many hours they lied on their timesheet. I don't see what's unclear about this, other than we have a fetish that we need to manage CPAs. And I think that's why we have a talent crisis in this profession. We're eating our young. They don't manage people at Google. They don't manage people at Apple. These are really, really smart knowledge workers. And we think that we're going to micromanage them by making them account for every 6 minutes of their day like they're prisoners. It's not why people join this profession. We join this profession to help people, not to be measured based on a ridiculous metric that should have no place in a modern-day firm.
Well, I've been in practice a long time. It's always a struggle to make a living when you have your own practice. Even no matter how well you do, there's always ups and downs. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of examples where timesheets have been immensely helpful to me in managing the staff. I hired a new manager. He went to clients. He did the work. I got clients off my back. I didn't have to deal with them. He brought back the right product. He did a great job. I looked at the timesheet at the end of the year, and let's say he spent 120 hours on the client. And I got paid for every penny, and he did a great job. I said, well, I can't have you spending 120 hours on that client. I can't grow, and you can't grow. So I said, next year you have to spend 60 hours, and you have to bring somebody, you have to train them to take over 60 of the hours you did. Even if they spend 100 hours, I don't care. But you have to use it to download your time. You're spending too much time there. And I actually used that as an example to teach them how to manage and how to supervise. Plus, I had to teach them how to supervise, because even though he was a manager, when he came to me, he didn't know how to supervise. So that's one example. Another example is I looked at a timesheet, and somebody from the tax department, who I didn't have a high regard for personally, just to be honest with you. Sometimes people rub you the wrong way. Nothing wrong with them, but they rub you the wrong way, so you don't bother with them. I looked at timesheets, and he's on a half a dozen clients. I don't know why he was on the clients. So I asked the people in charge. He said, well, I had a question, and I couldn't get an answer from the tax department, so I asked him. And then I went through it. I found he was a sleeper that his peers recognized as him, which I never knew about or would have recognized. This has nothing to do with billing clients or anything like that. So it's a management tool. That's how I use it.
So you can see a year later where people are spending their time.
Well, I could see a year later, but I could also see a month later or 2 months later, depending.
Okay. On well, hence the cookies and the smoke alarm.
It's a lagging indicator. There's no question about that being a lagging indicator.
But the thing is, it doesn't help you perform better in the future just by calling somebody out and saying, oh, you spent all this time on this one client. And by the way, that's cost plus pricing. You can't spend 120 hours on that client. I need you to spend 60. Oh, you need to delegate more. Well, that's a management issue. All of this can be solved if we did after action reviews. Like the military in every country in the world does after action reviews. You finish a project, you get together as a team that worked on that project, and you talked about what went right, what went wrong, how could we do better next time. That will give you granular information that will help you improve future performance. Beating people over the head on timesheets is not going to help them improve one iota.
I taught somebody how to manage his time better, how to supervise people, and how to mentor people. And I taught,
you didn't need a timesheet to do that, though, Ed.
No, I did. And somebody else I taught to, I elevated him and gave him more advanced work because I saw that he was recognized for his ability by his peers.
But you don't need a timesheet for that, and it's a lagging indicator. All it does is confirm your initial suspicions.
I needed a timesheet for the second guy because I didn't want to bother with him. My partner and I, he was there, he did work, and we didn't want to bother. And the first guy, he cleaned up work for me. And when you hire a new person at that level, you just want to get work cleaned up. But we're not going to agree.
What's your question, Ron?
No other business uses timesheets. I mean, my cousin works for Amazon.
My electrician uses a timesheet.
Who does?
My electrician uses a timesheet.
Look, auto mechanics charge by time. Electrician, I won't hire them. But plumbers charge. But Ed, the difference is if an electrician will give you a price. Now he may finish in half the time that he quoted that price on, but he's not going to adjust the price based on the time that he spent.
So I have been running into a lot of people who bill on time and track their time in this gig economy, all billing me hourly for stuff as much as I don't want it, and they don't want it too. They all still do it. There's a lot of professions out there that are all just resorting to, I have an hourly rate.
It's endemic, Scott. As cost plus pricing is endemic, and it's suboptimal. That was the largest argument in my book. Not only is it the wrong theory of value, which has been completely discredited, but it's a suboptimal pricing method. Smart companies like Apple and Amazon and OpenAI are not cost plus pricing. It's a suboptimal pricing method that leaves billions of dollars on the table. Apple, I can promise you, is not cost plus pricing.
Neither of us, Ed or I, are in favor of pricing on time. Like I guess in a way I'm seeing that inadvertently that's what's happening, and it's subtle.
It's not subtle. It's part of the system. You get what you measure. Peter Drucker said this all the time. You get what you measure. He didn't say what you can measure, you can manage. Drucker never said that, nor did he believe it. He said you get what you measure, and you get it good and hard.
And if you're measuring time,
if you're measuring time, people are going to give you time. Look, if you want to get technical about this, it's known as super irrigation, when the measurement takes over the strategy. For example, Wells Fargo told its people, you know, we want to strengthen our relationship with customers. And the KPI that they selected to measure progress towards that goal was, we're going to have 8 accounts per customer, because the more hooks we put into them, the more loyal they'll be. So all Wells Fargo employees started to go out and, you know, open savings accounts and all these different accounts, right? It was probably the most expensive KPI in free market history, because it cost them billions and billions of dollars, because Wells Fargo didn't have a strategy that said open 8 accounts per customer. They had a strategy that said strengthen relationships with customers. The KPI that was 8 accounts per customer took over. That process is known as super irrigation. There's a brilliant Harvard Business Review article on this. And that's what happens with the timesheet. The timesheet takes over everything. It takes over your attitude about management, about lessons learned, and about pricing. It's integral to the system. And that's why it needs to be pulled out. It's the cancer.
Ed, can you imagine running your practice without time?
Can't. But we certainly run the practice without billing, probably billing 80% of what we bill on fixed, some sort of fixed subscription fee or value price. But you can't run a, you can't supervise 1,000 people without a timesheet. in my opinion.
Well, Ed, thousands of firms do it. So I'm really curious to know what you think.
If there's 45,000 firms in the country and thousands of firms, so you got 3,000 or 4,000 firms doing it. I did a retreat. I did a virtual retreat with about a dozen or 15 firms when COVID started. And I had one-person firms. Now, in my mind, you think a one-person firm would do what I did when I had my firm, set a fee in advance, you get paid every month, whatever. Two of the women, two sole practitioners in that thing, they were sole practitioners, had nobody working for them. Every client got billed for every minute of time they spent. I couldn't believe it. I looked at their numbers, I spoke to them, I saw things they could have done better, some things they were doing great, and it blew my mind that I had one-person firms that are doing 100% on time, and it worked for them. So the answer is, people do what works for them. Right now, there is 90% of the firms are using some sort of timesheets, works for them. Maybe 10 years from now, it'll be a lower number. Maybe we'll have different ways of tracking. I did a job a couple of years ago. I was asked to help somebody sell his business and run the process. It's about a $100,000 fee. So I told the guy that I would do it and I would charge him on fixed fees for each stage. And I ended up getting about $100,000 each stage. Every time I reached the next stage, I had to give him the next thing. If it was on a time basis. By the way, it was one weekend I worked that I had to work a Memorial Day weekend. I charged him $8,000 for the week. On Tuesday, I charged him $8,000 extra for the weekend. I told him Friday, I got to work this weekend. I'm going to charge you for it. I charged him and he paid it, you know. But the time probably would have worked out smoother and simpler because I had to, and then even though I broke down the job into 10 phases, three phases more came up that weren't factored in, which I had to give fees for. So looking back, I would have been better off, and the client, I think, would have been better off just getting a bill, getting the hourly bill. It would have reduced the intercourse we had, the times he called me, I could tell you that. But by having a fixed fee, I got the extra calls that I wanted from him. So I was more effective with the fixed fee, but in the long run, I think the time fee might have been better.
Ron, do you care to respond to that?
No, it's just that when I'm doing something that's at the top of the value curve for the customer, that's when you want to run away from the timesheet as fast as possible and time-based pricing.
Top of the value curve. All right,
top of the value curve, absolutely. I mean, Ed, there would have been other ways to handle that pricing engagement. It sounds like you did it because you put it into phases, but I would have, depending on how well I knew the client and the relationship I had, I'm a big advocate of tips. Just tell the client, look, we're going to do whatever it takes to sell this. And I'm going to be with you every step of the way. When done, pay me what you think it's worth. Probably would have been paid millions.
I don't like that because that creates a bias on your part to see that the deal closes. Because if you do all the work, you do a great job. And then I had deals that were blown up the day before the closing.
Oh, sure.
So if I was on a tip basis, I would have got paid for that. So I knew I got paid for everything I did. Also, I would have been pushing the client. If my fee was based on closing, I'm pretty sure I went to push them, but there's a bias for the deal to close. And that's why investment bankers, brokers, they're not working for the seller or the buyer. They're working for themselves to get the deal done.
It's like lawyers with litigation. Yeah. They have an incentive to keep that litigation going forever. You know, they're paid not to finish. So incentives run both ways. I mean, there's no perfect solutions here. There are only trade-offs.
Everything's a trade. The lawyers that work on litigation where they get paid a percentage have the incentive to work as quickly as possible. There were lawyers who would take criminal cases and they say, it's this price. But if you go to trial, it's this price. Actually, I just read that in a Stuart Woods book. I wrote a blog.
Criminal attorneys definitely charge fixed pricing and always have. It's hard to send bills behind bars. Yeah.
So absolutely, the hours don't really necessarily matter. But there's always exceptions. Your method doesn't really allow for exceptions. my method gets confusing for the staff and maybe could be more effective in managing the practice. But the bottom line is everybody got to do what works best for them, and every firm has a different method of basically doing
it. Yeah. So I didn't realize how big this problem was with time until I started to poke my head outside of my world. And Ron, it is a big hill that you're climbing. I didn't realize that, like, even when I had you on early on, like, I didn't believe in it. Ackerman didn't. We didn't bill on time. We didn't track it. So we didn't think it was that big of a deal. It wasn't until, like, I started talking more and more. Almost every firm owner I know tracks time, except for the really small boutique ones. So there's this other subset of firm owners that I know that their firms aren't that large. They're doing things like CFO and advisory, and they're doing all the great things, all the sexy stuff. They may have like 10 or fewer clients. They're all paying premium white glove rates. They don't pay attention to time at all, and their clients love working with them. They're given the best service. They are the Disneys of our profession, but their firms are never that big. And then I go to the ones like Jody Grunden, and I found out about Jody through something that you refer to him. They're tracking time on everything, and all of it's time. And then the more firms I talk to, the larger ones, it's all down at the root of it. They could never change like Ed can't. Ed can't remove time from his practice. Their practices are foundationally stable and run, and they're built on these solid structures, and those structures are time. So as the more I learned, the more I realized this is a hard argument for you to face.
I have a different comment to make. One of the keys to not keeping timesheets is more effective and better methods of management. And I certainly agree that you need better and more effective management. I have found out that there are partners in firms. Now, let's take a large firm. And the large firm has a managing partner, maybe a management committee, and they have partners. They have a partner in charge of the tax department, a partner in charge of 8 clients that have a team of 12 people. These partners are managing a practice. It's not the practice, but they're managing the practice. They got to manage the scheduling of the work, the staffing of the work, the growth of the people, succession in the thing, and they got to manage the soft skills. None of these partners, and Ron, you should look at this, and Scotty, here's a question. None of these partners take CPE courses, take MAP courses. You know, people call me. I get a lot of calls. I get 30, 40 calls a month, and people talk about timesheets with time billing. I asked them if they ever heard of Ron Baker. Now, I'm telling you, you're going to be brain dead if you never heard of Ron Baker. And these schmucks never heard of Ron Baker, and they want to talk to me about timesheets and time billing. I mean, that was maybe 15 years ago, they didn't hear of you. You know how I heard of you? Actually, I've been reading your stuff for a long time, but I wrote an article one time that I talked about something about timesheets. It's got to be 15 years ago. And I must have had 25 people write to me hate mail. None of you weren't one of them, but they were all disciples of you. Scotty mentioned the word your scriptures. You're like an evangelist. And these were your followers. And they were sending me hate mail. And about time, you know.
And you're still getting it today from Ron's followers.
No,
technically, I am one of Ron's followers.
No, I don't get it anymore. And that tells me that it's not as big an issue as it used to be. I wrote an article. Actually, Rick Telberg posted an old, this got to be 10 years ago, posted an old thing that I wrote. I decided I don't want to do any more timesheet crap because I don't want to have a fight with anybody. I don't want to debate Ron.
He emailed me off the record. He says, I don't know if I really wanted to.
you're too good with this stuff. But so Rick Telberg posted this thing. I got 60 people, Ron didn't, but they were all disciples of you. In fact, Paul Don, who I know you met Paul Don in 1988, 2098, I think. You wrote that you met him in 98, I think, or 96?
Yeah, 96, yeah.
Oh, you met him. I met him in 2000, and we spoke on programs together. And he's writing me mail. He's He's posting things. Ed, you don't know what you're talking about. You're out of your league and everything. But 60 things. Jody Pidar, who I had dinner with and I'm friends with, writes me this hate stuff about timesheets. I told Rick Tobin, don't post anything more about timesheets. However, the calls I've been getting about timesheets have died out. And that gives me a pulse. Okay, I don't know what's going on, but I could tell from calls. I don't get any calls about marketing. I never got calls about marketing. Everybody's too busy. They don't want more. They complain they're not making enough, and then they don't want more business, or they don't do the organic growth that they can get. I'm not getting any more calls about timesheets. So it tells me it's an old issue. You know, I'm not saying.
Well, I get calls about it all the time, but how to get rid of them, and is it really possible?
I could tell you that I can't speak for Witham because I'm not in the management committee, or I'm emeritus now.
Emeritus.
I can't imagine they could manage without timesheets, but most of their billing is not done on time.
To me, that's an amazing statement that a business can't run without timesheets. Most businesses do. The only reason, I mean, my cousin works at Amazon. He doesn't do a timesheet. Now, I'm not talking, he's not a factory worker.
What does he do at Amazon? Does he pack books? What is it? He works for AWS? What does he do?
No. He works in the music division. He's responsible for programming and projects on their music platforms. And he develops that and he runs teams. And they do it all without timesheets. Massive project management. Massive. You think our project management's a big deal in a CPA firm? It ain't nothing compared to what Amazon or Google or Apple does. Apple doesn't have timesheets. Google doesn't have timesheets. I'm just really curious, why do professional firms have timesheets and all these other businesses that we see, and I'm in Silicon Valley for crying out loud, none of them do timesheets. Why is that? Well, because their business model isn't we sell time. See, when your business model is we sell time, then you do timesheets because that's part of the system.
Accounting firms send people out to clients. Accounting work is not done in the office. It's done at clients' premises, and it's done in teams. And some of these teams can have 40, 50 people working on a team. And you got to have a way of controlling what's going on. And you can't have it, you can't assemble team meetings every day or every week. But you can look at the time sheets to see what's being done. And I think that could be a difference. I don't know what Amazon does with music. But
you could look at project management information and workflow. This is all about work. You're talking about workflow.
So,
and that has nothing to do with time spent. That has to do with hitting deadlines, you know, finishing things on time, like FedEx, on-time arrival, those types of metrics.
Everything your accounting firm does has a deadline.
That's right. And we don't track it, Ed. We don't track them. We don't track deadlines. We don't tell the customer when they're going to get their pizza like Domino's does.
No.
It goes into a black box and it comes out when we're good and ready. We don't commit to the customer a delivery date.
The financial statement's still on a certain date. It has to go to a bank. The tax return has to go to the government. You know, we do commit to deadlines, and we have internal deadlines.
Well, but there's statutory deadlines that we commit to more than our own, Mr. Customer, you're going to get this back on X date.
Yeah, that's right. But if a client wants me to help him sell his business, there's 5 deadlines a day on that project. But if a client wants me to come up with a compensation plan for key management, it could be open-ended. It could take me 2 months.
Oh, I agree with that.
It's hard to manage people. We're not very good at it, especially a lot of us accountants. I'm not very good at it. I know I ran into all of my problems when I started trying to manage people and learning how to do that. And I think therein lies the problem. I think when you're dealing with products and you're dealing with other things that are scalable, you know, you can have fixed measures and measure all the outputs and do all those things. But when it comes to managing people, when ultimately the relationship is the product in a lot of these professional services, this is where it gets really hard for a lot of accountants who are used to dealing with the work. And now you got to deal with emotions and people and all of these other different things. Like, we just need a structure, a system, something to look at on paper.
Yeah, that's because we rather be precisely wrong rather than approximately right. We'll take a measurement that is very, very objective. We can hang our hat on a timesheet. You spent 2.5 hours on that, 2.25 hours, whatever. But we're scared to death of making a judgment. And yet in a knowledge organization, A judgment is infinitely more valuable than a measurement. Because at the end of the day, you're judging the success of your doctor. You're not measuring it. It's his bedside manner or her bedside manner, how they treat you. Do they condescend when they talk to you? All these personal subjective feelings are the sum of a successful CPA. It's cute to think that we can manage people, but you can't. We need to manage the work and stop trying to manage the people. This is a profound insight from Jody Thompson of Best Buy, formerly Best Buy. She's the one that started the results-only work environment. And if you know about the ROWE, R-O-W-E, results-only work environment, you know it aligns perfectly with no timesheets. But she says, you don't manage the workers, you manage the work. This idea that we can manage other people like they're bags of cement, we can move around. I mean, Stalin tried it, didn't have much success with it. I mean, we need to give this up. These are really, really smart knowledge workers. Turn them loose. You know, Steve Jobs used to say, we here at Apple, we hire people smarter than we are so they can tell us what to do, not so that we can tell them what to do.
I agree 100% with managing the system.
So here's what happened. I hired people to tell me that we needed to track time. That's what we're doing, and that's what we think we're doing, is we're managing the people and we're not managing the outcomes. We're not managing the work. So this goes back to all of the written scripture of Principal Baker, of our principal. Now mixing the religious and the school with all of these.
Scott, there's a great line that systems thinkers use, and it is, your firm is optimized to get the results it's getting now. And that's your system. Your system has a rhythm and cadence.
And those results could be okay. That's why I go by OKR. They're okay results.
You asked me why it's such a challenge to get firms to get rid of timesheets. Well, first off, it's pretty hard to get millionaires to change their business models, you know. But we go through a thing, you know, there's this concept the economists use called satisfice. It's a combination of satisfy and sufficient. In other words, we don't try and optimize or maximize our profits. We do good enough, and that's, we satisfice, because it takes too much mental energy to expend to try and optimize or maximize. So we do good enough. And you know what? Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We'll take it. It's good enough. People understand it. They work in the system. It's optimized for the results it gets. I just think we can do better as a profession, and I still blame the timesheet for losing talent, because you, and Ed, I know you know this, and I still talk to people who have left public accounting, talk to them within the first year, and ask them about their new job at controller, you know, their controller or CFO somewhere. How do you like the job? What's the first thing out of their mouth?
They I don't have to do timesheets anymore, but that's not why people leave. They leave because the money, they leave because they're not getting the experience that they want, they're not getting the opportunity, and they're not getting excited.
That's true, but the timesheet adds to that tension, and it puts it in their face every day that this is not what I signed up for.
When I get a lead for a new client, the guy always says, I'm looking for a new accountant. I say, wait, since I'm paying too much taxes. And then I speak to him. First 5 minutes, I speak to him. We dispose of taxes, and then we spend another 55 minutes of the hour talking about his controls and system, which is really what keeps him awake at night. But he can get blamed for the system, but he can't get blamed for overpaying taxes. Timesheets is a very good way of saying, I left because of timesheets, because they were paying me crummy. They weren't paying me overtime. They weren't paying me for tax season. They maybe work 75 hours a week. I didn't get good experience. They're not going to say that. I had to do timesheets. I think we have a big problem. And first of all, we have non-managing partners that don't know how to manage a team or supervise a group. And we're losing people because of that. People don't quit a firm. They quit their boss. And they don't quit a firm because they had to do timesheets. But they quit the work they're doing. They quit the opportunities. So I think that we need the non-managing partners to take serious CPA. I think that's where. Another thing we're doing is the payment model is for tax season especially is terrible. You tell people to work 60 to 70 hours a week, and you don't pay them. It's built into the fees. I think we're losing people because of that. I made a recommendation in the last issue of CPA Journal that everybody should raise their starting salaries immediately 20% and raise all the salaries after that 20%, and the pipeline problem would alleviate a lot. We're doing stupid things. We don't manage the system. Every firm has a system. A lot of systems may not be good, but it's their system, and then they don't follow it. And if you have a firm with five partners, they have five systems, maybe six systems, because a manager has his own system. You got to manage the system. You got to have a strong system. I've managed the system. And when I merged with them, everybody working for me started with my firm. I trained every single person in their job, the accountants, the marketing person, the bookkeeper, and my administrative assistant. So I've done this, and I found out a long time ago that I am richer hiring people out of school, training them everything, than hiring 3-year people who leave their job because they didn't get a good experience because they have experience. So I think that we have to look at those things. We need organic growth to our clients. This artificial, I was using ChatGPT. My firm doesn't want me to use that. They want me to use Copilot. Same thing. I had a mind-blowing, I spent about 45 minutes Friday on unbelievable. It's mind-blowing.
AI is making your mind blow. It's mind-blown.
It was great using it, but things are changing. Clients are getting this stuff in real time, and we have to have it real time plus, and we have to tell them how to interpret. We have to drag our clients forward, not have them feel they outgrew us.
All technology is going to continue to eat hours, and that's going to be a real problem if you're in the we sell time business model. So it's going to put more pressure on billable hours. I do think we have a talent issue. And, you know, if you think about the funnel, there's the top of the funnel. How do we get more kids in high school and college to think about matriculating into accounting? The middle of the funnel, how do we stop the bleed out from, you know, the accounting profession after 3, 4, 5 years? And of course, the end of the funnel, people retiring and dying. We have an aging profession. 3/4 are eligible for retirement, according to the AICPA, within 10 years, which is a demographic ticking time bomb. AI will alleviate some of that pressure, I think, as it automates tasks that, you know, we probably shouldn't be doing in the first place. I think offshoring, Scott, that I know you do and you talk a lot about, is helping to alleviate it. I don't think the talent competition is going anywhere. We're seeing a worldwide talent competition for talent. I think the partnership model is under enormous stress. We're starting to see alternative models, dark horses out there, venture capital. We're going to interview a test partner from Eisner Ampner and get a look at his test model. You got BDO doing an ESOP. So I think we're starting to see some innovation with respect to structural and governance issues. And I do want to just go back to, you ask any CPA why they became a CPA, and you'll land on to help people. And I just think we need to go back and put the relationship first, which is why I still think the subscription model is going to be a big part of our future. And that's not just about dividing a payment by 12 and being paid monthly. You've got to plus the offering. You've got to do like the concierge doctors and the direct primary doctors are doing. You've got to just handle whatever the customer needs when they need it in a very frictionless way. I think we need to up our game when it comes to customer experience. We need to make it very clear to our customers that not only do we save them time, we save them time. To the extent that we measure time in this profession, I think we should measure it based on the time we save the customer and the time they spend with us. When they spend time with us, we have to convince them that that's time well invested. It's like an audience giving Taylor Swift their attention, you know, and paying a fortune for it, or the Super Bowl. I mean, a business with an audience is a true blessing. Because now you're not paying for the customer's time. They're willingly paying you to spend time with you. And I think that's where the subscription model can really make a difference and change what we monetize rather than this fee-for-service treadmill we're on. I think we need to go back to just looking at customer lifetime value and forget about the math of the moment and up our game with customer experience.
Absolutely. By the way, when I had my subscription model, it gave me, we didn't have to watch, really, we kept track of the time, but we weren't concerned about the time, so to speak, because we had a client for a long time. But when it gave me the freedom to come up with ideas for the client. Now, I could have five ideas, maybe one works. But most clients are not going to want to pay you for the four ideas that are not going to work, especially if it's the first four. But when it's my dime, it gave me the freedom to experiment and to imagine and to try things. And then when you hit something, you give the client a freebie, and then you build it into the fee or you charge extra as a secondary product line that you're offering them. So it offers a lot of potential. I bought a practice in 1993. The guy, at the time, my rate was $125 an hour. This guy's rate was $46 an hour. He billed every minute of his time. So what we did, we bought the practice. We went to his business, we didn't care about the individual. We went to the business clients and said, look, last year you paid George $12,000 a year. We're going to charge you $1,000 a month. But what we're going to do is we're going to convert all your stuff to computer. And I'm still going to provide you the information he provided. The conversion will be an hour time, and this way it's a fixed fee. You don't pay for that. Within 2 years, we were making a lot of money on those clients. But one of those clients last year, we billed double or triple. Last year, we billed, but we paid for the whole practice over 5 years. But this subscription model, the fixed price, the value pricing, these things work. And it's a concept that a lot of people don't understand. But the system has to be sacrosanct. I was in a subway in Korea, in the airport, and I got a 6-inch tuna fish subway in Korea, the same thing I had for lunch today.
And it tastes the same, too.
It's exactly the same. I had it today in East Brunswick.
Did you know Subway is the biggest chain?
Yeah, I heard that.
I think it is.
Is it really?
I don't know, but I lately found certain Subways are starting to close.
Yeah.
Which they never, 10 years ago, they never closed. Now they're starting to close. So they got a problem with their model. But irrespective of that, it's the system. It's the system in every franchise, and the accounting firms have to run their practice the same way. Because we're going to give every single person working for every firm today is going to be gone at some point. Unless they become a partner. They're all going to be gone. You don't have permanent people. You might have them for 10 or 20 years, but at some point they're going to be gone. So you got to have the system. I couldn't hire people out of school and train them and make them make more, have them make money for me.
But that's an interesting point. At that point right there, you're trying to create something that's going to outlive all the people in it, right? You're trying to create a system or create an organization that outlives the people that are there. How do you get the people to come in and still have the mindset to help grow that? You know what I mean? Like, how do you keep them engaged at the time that they're there and caring?
I did it. I had people working for me more than 10 years. I did it. You could do it. Every firm's doing it. The big four will do it. The top 100 are all doing it. They all have systems. They're keeping the people. They have turnovers. Some of them have... You know, PricewaterhouseCoopers in 2022 had a 25% turnover, and they were listed in a survey of the 100 best firms to work for.
Yeah, they always are.
25%. Yeah. Imagine having 25% turnover.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That was in their publication. They published an annual report with that number. It's the system. And I could tell you, I could see it from a small standpoint. You know, when I ran my practice, I don't want to use bad words, but I had to be a real son of a to make people follow the system, because there's resistance on the staff and the partners to follow the system. And by me making everybody, I took the heat, so to speak. And I'm not telling you, people went home at night thinking I was the best guy in the world, because they didn't. But they didn't quit, because they went home happy. And they followed the system religiously.
That's part of the mindset that got me to where I am. I wouldn't have been able to have my practice run without me if there wasn't strict systems in place. But all of those systems led down the path to time
goes back to that. That's how we ended up where we are. I created something that could run without me and that operates, and it's good, but it's not awe-inspiring, Ron. It's not like going to grow like crazy. It's good. It's manageable. Everybody's happy. I don't have people leaving. All of that.
When we did our interview, I gave you at least 7 or 8 edits of organic growth.
I know you did, Ed. I know, and I still want to go rap. I still don't care that much about doing that. I still want to go out and perform.
Your staff might care about it. That's how they
do. They listen to it. I had them listen to the episode. And they have ideas, but they're not that excited about doing new things either.
No, it's you got
to. I have to push them to, and I'm ready to, and I'm ready to push them more and to have us expand our horizons and do more. It still doesn't change the fact that I happened to stumble upon the fact that they were using time to bill. Like, those kind of things are happening.
Yeah, that was a throwaway question I asked you at the end, just so we covered it.
Scott, I was just going to say, Ed reminded me of the other thing I'm really inspired by is firms such as yours and, you know, the Jody Paydars and the Jason Blummers and all of these new people that are coming in building a firm different from their father's CPA firm. I'm really encouraged by that, whether or not they do time or bill hours or do timesheets. I see some new blood coming in, some new vision, and I also see a big movement, more than I've ever seen in this profession, towards specialization. And as you know, I'm a big believer in specialization. We got to stop believing we can be all things to all people. You know, if CPA firms were veterinarians, I think their sign outside the office would say veterinarian and taxidermist, so they could say, either way, you'll get your cat back. And that just doesn't work. Strategy is all about focus and what you don't do. A firm is defined.
Ron, too, Ron. That was a good one.
A firm is defined by the services it doesn't have and the customers it doesn't have. Porsche is not out there for everybody. You know, the CEO of Porsche is on record saying, if there are two Porsches on the same block, that's an absolute tragedy. That's a different strategy than Toyota and General Motors and Ford. And I'm seeing...
That's the boutiques I was talking about. Well, they're very profitable, and they do very well.
Yeah, they're coming up, they're putting their personality, they're putting a purpose first, rather than just, you know, billing time or growing 10% or increasing realization by 5%. I mean, they're putting a purpose out there. We're here to help people. We're here to make their lives better, whether it's personal lives, business lives. And we can do that from womb to tomb. We can help somebody get in college when they're born, and we can help them plan their legacy when they're gone. That's an incredibly privileged position that we're perched upon. And we need to stop selling services and selling hands, pair of hands, and start guiding our customers to higher levels, not just solve their problems. Because if all we're doing is solving problems, we're just reverting the customer back to the status quo. We're not progressing and advancing them. And we're in the position to be able to do that. And I think that's exciting, and that will always be the case. No matter what AI does, you're still going to need a human oracle. And that's why I'm very bullish on this profession going forward.
I'm very bullish also. But just to tell you how the personal element is important, Scott and I spoke for an hour. And somehow, somewhere along the line, we came out that he had timesheets, and then he followed up and found that they're not using it the way it's supposed to. That's what I have always done with my clients, to find that thing that they don't know about their business. And that will never...
Well, Ed, the one thing that you always talk about is your relationships with your clients. And you always talk... So you never talk about time in particular. You never talk... You're always talking about the interactions that you had with your clients and what you've done. And then in the rears, you're billing them for it, or they're tipping you $100,000. You got tipped out $100,000 after a business sold, and everything worked out for them. So you did, in essence, do what Ron is talking about. You're just doing it through your actions.
It wasn't part of the deal. It wasn't mentioned, but I asked for it, and I got it. Because I found out.
We've already talked about it a lot, yeah.
On that M&A deal I mentioned, I didn't keep track of my time at all. Didn't matter. I wasn't interested, but one of the things that I've done is help clients, and I never get the credit for it because I help them avoid problems, and you don't get credit when they don't have a problem. But I did have the relationship. It continued. my fees always went up every year, no matter what. And occasionally, I needed a 30% or 35% bump up in the fee. I would get it. I'd have to work at it, you know, make my case. But at the end of the day, I made a very good living. I always had money to grow my practice, my infrastructure, and I had a profit somewhere along the line. So I had a good practice. Did I make millions of dollars a year? No. But I had a good time, and I like what I did. And it's a lot of fun.
And you made an impact on people.
I feel I made an impact, and I feel good about what I've done.
It's about having an impact on people, as I've learned, as I've talked to you about that, Ron. Like, when I worked with clients and I was in the practice, I was having an impact on people, and I felt that, and it energized me. As I exited, now, like, I don't feel that impact as much.
You're having a different impact, Scott, now.
A different impact,
It's more wholesale rather than retail, but it's there.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't see it or smell it until I see people in person and they tell me they're listening or things like that. Otherwise, it just feels like you're speaking into a void. And Ed, you're doing it too. You're doing just that. You're doing it much more written. But you guys both became teachers, essentially, in your own right. Part of the philosophers that speak the word of the people. So one by doing and the other by creating followers or disciples that'll all speak the gospel for you. We may not all agree on different ways of managing and methods and all that, but at the end of the day, it's still about helping people, right? Helping people find new paths for their own business or see new opportunities or create new pathways within a profession that, in all honesty, is a sinking ship, it feels like. It feels like we're on the Titanic just playing the music as it sinks in some, if you listen to the news.
No, it's growing. It's growing. We're getting stronger. Good.
I want to hear more of that.
You can imagine how much technology is being used, even by small firms. The audit procedures have been reduced tremendously. People are doing peer reviews virtually. You know, the COVID speeded up adoption of a lot of things. But I've been with them 19 years, and 19 years ago, I was working virtually. Even I might have been sitting in my office, but the person two offices down got an email with the file, and there was no personal interaction, except if they, you know, except I have to get up every once in a while and talk to them. But we've been working virtually for 19 years. It speeded up what's happening. I spoke to a guy, an accountant, solo owner in Cyprus last week, who has a virtual employee in Malaysia that he never met. And she wants a raise. And he wanted to talk to me about it. I don't know the guy. I never met him or anything. But this is exciting stuff. And I'm able to help particularly sole practitioners or misguided partners in larger firms that don't feel satisfied. You know, you mentioned your firm is... Your job should be a chief cheerleader of your practice to make sure that people working for you go home excited. And you got to figure out the ways to...
Where are they going home to? They're working from home. They're always at home.
When they shut down the computer for that night or for that hour or to go to the bathroom, they got to be excited. And you got to excite them. And that's something I've been able to do.
All right. You want me to share a conversation that happened after we had our episode, Ed? I had our Christmas party next day.
You said that.
And you had me questioning a lot of stuff after that episode. You said, where's the loyalty? And I asked them that. And I asked them the same questions you asked me during our Christmas party. Everybody had a few drinks and stuff, but they love their jobs. They love interacting with clients. One of them, he just retold what he did to help somebody. And he really felt like he helped them. And he really impacted that client. And that made him feel good. It wasn't the Christmas bonus. It wasn't what I pay him. They don't give a that they're tracking time. They don't care about any of that stuff. It was like they're feeling the impact that I used to feel, that kind of stuff that used to happen to me. And they're helping people.
If you don't inspire them to grow in your practice, at some point they're going to leave. Whatever they told you that they were excited about, you have to build on that.
What are some ways you guys suggest I build on that?
Well, Scott, I think one of the main roles of a leader, and I'm dubious about that term, but we'll use it for now. The main role of a leader is to create leaders. And you've done that. You shouldn't beat yourself up too much. You've done that. You've turned a firm into leaders that are running that firm without you. That's pretty good.
So in a way, I can see myself as a leader now. That's never something I was ever comfortable with.
You know, keep in mind that a leader is a verb, not a noun. Leadership is very, very contextual. Anybody can be a leader in a given moment. You know, somebody who's taking over a sinking ship or the captain died or whatever. I mean, it's very contextual. And it sounds like you've built a firm that other people have stepped into and are carrying it forward. And that's impressive.
Well, Ed, I am proud to say that they have turned off the waiting list that they created, and they've turned it back on the faucet for all the clients. And I have other new news that you guys would both like to hear. My daughter is interested in getting into accounting. She wants to be an accountant.
How old is she?
Well, you got her singing all these rap songs about it.
I was naive to think like that I would not have any kind of influence. And I also didn't want to push her into anything at all. Like say, you got to become this or you got to do this and all that. Her and her friends think I'm cool. So that's why they want to be. So even her friends too, they're in high school and they took accounting classes and they're into it. And so I'm having an impact on the next generation of kids, I guess.
That's awesome.
In my home.
That's
yeah. So I now have another pipeline of people that I can potentially hire, and I can start them off out pretty young, Ed, like you did with your people. Hire them right out of school, right?
You know, I found just speaking at both colleges and high schools that it's easier to inspire the high school students than it is the college students, and give them like Ed was talking about, give them the real view of what.
That's why this is called Accounting High.
Yeah,
this is why we're on Accounting High. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, there's a lot of misperceptions among high schoolers about what it is accountants do, and once they learn that, no, we're really financial psychiatrists, and we spend 80% of our time interacting with people. Kind of blows them away. You know, we're not in the back room with the eye shade crunching the numbers.
Yeah, because that's the media perception of the accountant.
It is.
In every movie, I appreciate you guys. This was awesome. I know we didn't necessarily solve the world's problems when it comes to time, but we did have a healthy conversation about it. There was nothing below the belt. Nobody, you know.
No rabbit punches.
I'm honestly going to say nobody won either, because this is still an ongoing debate. So absolutely. We've installed another epic interaction in the saga of time as it continues.
There's no solutions, only trade-offs.
Only trade-offs. It depends.
Really good. Thanks for arranging it.
Dope. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
appreciate y'all.
Thanks, Ed.
Peace out. Class dismissed.